It is Monday, October the 9th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, U.S. North Korea tensions and Japan.
If something happens that suggests to the Japanese that America is not going to defend them, and that would be in the event of, a missile attack or other sort of an attack or pressure or harm caused by North Korea.
Also ahead, U.S.-Iranian relations, demonstrations in Spain, a protest by the U.S. Vice President, plus the music of Linda Ronstadt. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Speaking to the North Korean Central Committee of the Workers' Party, Kim Jong-un said the nuclear weapons agenda is that he has called for a powerful deterrent that guarantees sovereignty for his country and for the peninsula. For some insight into what the North Korean leader is saying, VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with Grant Newsham, senior fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies based in Tokyo.
His statements about it being a sort of a guarantor of peace and stability in the region, of course, should be taken with a large grain of salt. But it's definitely, for his self-preservation that he wants these weapons, and he's clear about them, but he says he's going to get them, and it's been a steady march towards them. And I expect it will continue unless it's interrupted. It's Kim's strategic objective, which is often overlooked by many observers, really is to reunify the peninsula by force if necessary and under North Korean control. And one way to move this along or get headed in that direction is to be able to threaten the United States with nuclear weapons and thereby create some distance possibly between South Korea and the United States. So it is important to look at Kim's nuclear weapons program as in terms of his longer-term objectives, which is not just to stay in power and stay alive, but also to reunify the peninsula.
Is his nuclear program viewed by the North Korean regime as offensive or defensive in nature?
Oh, he can characterize it any way he wants. It's presented, of course, for public consumption or outside North Korea as defensive. And even internally, it's defensive to protect North Korea from all its enemies, particularly the Americans. But really, and this is the thing that is often overlooked, it is very much viewed as having an offensive component, although the North doesn't specifically say it, but it's widely believed that is the case.
You probably have heard the remarks by President Donald Trump on Saturday that only one thing will work in dealing with North Korea.
Well, he's got a point there. But of course, what we've never tried are real sanctions. There have been sanctions applied, but these have been half-hearted, haphazard, and really have amounted to almost nothing, with the exception of the sanctions applied to Bunkel Delta Asia in Macau in the mid-2000s. And those were really a look at what is possible. The Bush administration withdrew them, gave the North Koreans their money back, all in exchange for a promise to talk, nothing more. But ironically, it is Mr. Trump's administration which is applying some systematic and deeper sanctions against North Korea. And he's gotten more countries to go along with that. You have Spain, Italy, Mexico, even Kuwait have sent back or are going to send back North Korean ambassadors. Any previous administration could have done this. None of them did. So Mr. Trump, for all his tweeting, he may have a point, actually, about at the end of the day, there is no way to talk North Korea out of this. But his administration, if you look at what it's actually done, has for the first time in 25 years made a more conscious, concerted effort to really pressure North Korea, but also pressure the People's Republic of China. And without sanctions against China, there's really no sanctions against North Korea that the United States could apply, which would cause the North to back down.
Are those sanctions working?
Well, it takes time. It's only been about maybe at the most 9 months since the Trump administration has been in place. I'd say give it time, but the thing to really look for is what sanctions get applied to the People's Republic of China. And particularly the day you see the Bank of China have its banking license in the United States suspended for 6 months, then you'll know some real sanctions are being applied or something along those lines. But it'll take some time. Given the alternatives, I'm personally inclined to give it a little time as well.
Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who's facing a snap election later this month, said Sunday his government fully supports the U.S. stance on pressuring North Korea over its nuclear weapons program. But you've written an article titled the Japan-U.S. relationship, How Strong is the Glue? So how strong is it?
It depends. If something happens that suggests to the Japanese that America is not going to defend them, and that would be in the event of, a missile attack or other sort of an attack or pressure or harm caused by North Korea, if the Americans did not back Japan fully to include potentially using force, that would shake the alliance. Additionally, and this is tends to get overlooked with all the focus on North Korea, is if the Chinese were to do something like grab the Senkaku Islands or an island down in southern Japan, the Japanese would expect full American support, once again, to include the use of the U.S. military. And if that doesn't happen, then I think we could find in very short order this alliance, which is regularly declared to be stronger than ever and unshakable, I think we could find it could come apart pretty easily. But it would take a serious incident like that. And in the meantime, Abe is doing his best to stay as close to the Americans, but he does expect really full American support in the event that Japan is attacked or suffers serious harm or loses some territory. And a statement by the Americans that dialogue is the best way to resolve things will not go over very well in Japan. And I think you would find that the relationship is indeed made of some soluble glue that can come apart.
Grant Newsham is a senior fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Iran has warned the United States against designating the Iranian Revolutionary Guards as a terror group by saying it would put the U.S. military at risk in the region if more sanctions were imposed by the United States on Tehran. We asked Ian Lustig, Middle East scholar at the University of Pennsylvania, for his read on this new development and the growing tensions between the U.S. and Iran.
This was a statement, I believe, made by the head of the Revolutionary Guards. It was not made by the supreme leader or by the president, but by the organization that's most concerned that it will be named a terrorist organization as a result of imposed sanctions. It is a credible threat. The threat was not to resume nuclear development, but to, if I understand it correctly, escalate and accelerate missile development and to threaten American ships within missile range as if they were at war with Iran in the same way that ISIS is at war with Iran. I think that's the comparison that was made.
And we also asked Dr. Lustig for his thoughts on any correlation between the U.S.-Iranian tensions and the situation between Washington and North Korea.
I think the larger picture here is that what we're seeing as a result of what I can only characterize as reckless behavior by President Trump toward both Iran, the Iran deal, and the situation with North Korea is that the United States is heading toward a zone of war with each of these countries. And both situations are combustible, highly combustible, for different reasons. In Korea, you're dealing with nuclear weapons, and you're dealing with two unconventional, to say the least, leaders who seem to enjoy and gravitate toward personalizing conflict and escalating conflict. With the Iranians, it's not quite as bizarre, but it's more normal in some sense. But still, the idea that President Trump would go against the opinion of his stated opinion of his defense secretary that the Iran deal is in American national interest just to score some political points risks war with Iran, just as we are risking war with North Korea.
Ian Lustig, a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Residents of Catalonia opposed to the regional government's efforts to secede from Spain rallied in Barcelona on Sunday. Police say 350,000 demonstrators attended, while organizers say more than 900,000 people joined in. We asked Catalan scholar Stuart King of Monash University if he was surprised by the huge numbers who turned out.
No, it wasn't really a surprise because the no vote in Catalonia has not really had much of a chance to express itself. As my reading of the press this morning here in Australia was that the because the referendum was declared illegal, many of them didn't turn out to vote. And this is their opportunity now that there is actually the possibility, or the Catalan government is talking about declaring independence. This is their chance now to articulate their desire to remain within Spain.
We also asked Dr. King what Catalan President Carles Puigdemont might say when he addresses Parliament on Tuesday.
That is an interesting question. I think he will declare that Catalonia is independent. I personally don't think that he is particularly in favor of independence. I think he has been sort of pushed into this by sort of political forces, much of which is his own making. But I think, yes, we will get a declaration of independence on the next time the Catalan Parliament meets.
That is Monash University Catalan scholar Stuart King. Opinion polls have consistently suggested more Catalans favor removing or remaining in Spain, that is, than declaring independence.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News.
U.S. Vice President Mike Pence has walked out of a professional football game that happened Sunday in his home state of Indiana after some of the players knelt during the playing of the national anthem. Pence said on Twitter, "I left today's Colts game because President Trump and I will not dignify any event that disrespects our soldiers, our flag, or our national anthem." President Trump tweeted that the walkout was not spontaneous. A number of pro football players have been kneeling at these games to protest racial injustice and social inequality in the United States. International Edition's Lori London talks to Los Angeles-based civil litigation attorney Eve Wagner, who has worked on numerous cases about the First Amendment, which is at the center of this controversy.
My take on it is the walkout is just another example of what has become a reality television White House. The vice president tweeting that he left today's Colts game because at POTUS, and I will not dignify any event that disrespects our soldiers, our flag, or our national anthem. And then following President Trump's tweet, following that up, which basically, like you said, seemed to make this a stage event. What's disappointing about this is it seems that the president and vice president are fueling what's a fundamental misunderstanding of what the players, managers, and owners are actually doing. It started as a peaceful protest or statement protesting police shootings and brutality against African Americans. It was never about disrespecting, which is a word they're using, the flag, the soldiers, or the national anthem. So what this looks like is President Trump and Vice President Trump are politicizing the issue by changing the narrative away from systemic racism into one about disrespecting flag and country, further dividing the country.
Would it be disrespectful to the flag?
What you're saying is it even disrespectful to engage in a silent protest during the playing of the national anthem? And one of the fundamental rights that we're guaranteed is the First Amendment. And what makes this an interesting issue is from a legal perspective, the First Amendment only applies to government action and not to private employers. But here you have the President of the United States, now followed by the Vice President through his conduct in walking out, and basically advocating that players be fired and that people shouldn't watch the games. That certainly appears to be violating at least the spirit of the First Amendment. So some would say that by doing what they're doing is actually an act of patriotism because they are protesting peacefully an issue that's very, very important. which is something that's a fundamental right guaranteed by our very First Amendment.
You know, and this comes on top of the fact that over the weekend, you know, we're dealing with a lot of racism issues in this country as it is. The protesting has to do with racial inequality. And then on top of that, over the weekend, we had another white supremacist rally in Charlottesville.
Exactly. And where were the tweets by the president or vice president then? This is just adding more fuel to the fire. They're changing the narrative away from the real subject of the peaceful statements made by the players into something that it's not.
Why do you think that is?
I think it feeds the base.
Coming from a lawyer's perspective, the legality of it and the constitutionality of it is that what you're saying is these people have every right to kneel, and it is not necessarily a disrespectful thing. It's just their right under the Constitution.
The Constitution, again, only protects you against government action. So technically, he's asking that the players be fired by their employer. So it really turns into, can players be fired for engaging in what looks like political speech? And then you look at a legal perspective, the union contract, their own individual contract, federal law and state law, and even local law. So it's not really a First Amendment issue, except for the fact that you have president and vice president calling for them to be fired. So it's sort of engaging in a slippery slope. One of the reasons some of the states actually enacted some of these laws protecting political speech came out of the McCarthy era. Back in the 1950s, when the government would identify someone as a communist, and then they would be fired the next day or blacklisted. And so some states pass laws specifically protecting political speech. This is political speech while you're at work. So it's an interesting constitutional issue.
But it's interesting, too, that the president and now vice president would really weigh in so heavily into something like this.
It's really all about, to me, reality television in the White House. Instead of focusing on North Korea, Puerto Rico, the neo-Nazis marching in Charlottesville, another hurricane. We're talking about football and whether somebody engaging in a peaceful protest or a bunch of players engaging in a peaceful protest against systemic racism somehow can be turned into they're not patriotic when they believe they're exercising their First Amendment right, whether the First Amendment applies or not.
Civil litigation attorney Eve Wagner speaking with my colleague Lori London. President Trump has issued his annual U.S. proclamation for Columbus Day, which is today here in the United States, without any of his predecessors' misgivings about the holidays. The proclamation urges Americans to celebrate Christopher Columbus's spirit of discovery of the Americas, a contrast to former President Barack Obama's document last year, which acknowledged that both Columbus's drive to explore and the suffering of Native Americans were linked. The holiday is celebrated on the second Monday in October. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A couple of years ago, the internet buzzed with news that a massive structure built by an advanced civilization of extraterrestrials might be orbiting a star located about 1,280 light-years from Earth. The erratic dimming and brightening of a star known as Tabby Star has stumped astronomers around the world. A new study using data from NASA's Spitzer and Swift missions as well as the Astrolab IRIS Observatory in Belgium rules out that an ET-built megastructure is the cause of the star's odd dimming patterns. Instead, the study suggests the cause is an uneven dust cloud moving around the star. Researchers say they found less of the dimming effect while observing in infrared light than in ultraviolet light. They add that any object larger than dust particles would show equal dimming in all wavelengths of light. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. In our report from the music department, five decades of award-winning sounds. Linda Ronstadt is an American pop and country music singer. She's been awarded 11 Grammys, 3 American Music Awards, 2 Academy of Country Music Awards, an Emmy, and many of her albums have been certified gold, platinum, or even multi-platinum in the U.S. and internationally. Born in 1946 in the U.S. city of Tucson, Arizona, Ronstadt was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2014. Also that year, she was awarded the National Medal of Arts and Humanities. You're No Good was a number one hit for Ronstadt, who also hit the charts with a big win with her song Blue Bayou.
I feel so bad, I got a worried mind. I'm so lonesome all the time. Since I left my baby behind on Blue Bayou. Saving nickels, saving dimes. Working till the sun don't shine. Looking forward to happier times on Blue Bayou.
Ronstadt's professional career got started in the mid-1960s at the forefront of California's folk rock and country rock movements, genres which define post-1960s rock music. During that period, she joined forces with Bobby Kimmel and Kenny Edwards and became the lead singer of a folk rock trio, the Stone Ponies. Ronstadt collaborated with tons of artists in multiple genres, including Frank Zappa, Rosemary Clooney, Emmylou Harris, Dolly Parton, Neil Young, Johnny Cash, and Aaron Neville, with whom she recorded Don't Know Much, which went to the top of the charts in 1989.
Look at this face. I know the years are showing. Look at this life. I still don't know where it's going. I don't know much, but I know I love you. And that may be all I need to know.
Look at these eyes, they've never seen what matters. Look at these dreams, so big and so better.
I don't know much, but I know I love you. That may be all I need to know.
After her last live concert in late 2009, Ronstadt retired. She was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease in December of 2012, which left her unable to sing. Since then, author Andrew Greeley, in his book God and Popular Culture, described Linda Ronstadt, in his words, as the most successful and certainly the most durable and most gifted woman rock singer of our era.
look at this man, so blessed with inspiration. Look at this soul, still searching for salvation. I don't know much, but I know I love you.
Really great together, aren't they, huh? Wow. Well, so many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America, an international edition. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead, and we hope you'll stay tuned for that. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Greg Burns, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We all hope that you have a great Monday. Now, a bit more from the duet of Linda Ronstadt and Aaron Neville.
But I know I love you. That may be all there is to know. Oh,
next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On October 12, 1492, three Spanish ships under the leadership of Christopher Columbus landed on an island in what is today the Bahamas. The anniversary of that event, observed annually in the United States as Columbus Day, initiated a vast global exchange of foods, animals, plants, peoples, and diseases that transformed the world, known today as the Columbian Exchange. For that reason, 1492 is considered by most historians to be the most significant year in modern world history. World population has increased more than four times since 1492, doubling between 1650 and 1850. Although a number of contributing factors are responsible for such enormous growth, clearly the most significant is an increased and improved food supply. The addition to the food supply of Native American food plants such as maize, potato, tomato, peanuts, manioc, pineapple, peppers, and cocoa beans was the most significant factor. The potato became the most important food source for the poor in Central and Northern Europe. Maize and manioc were introduced to Africa in the 16th century and replaced traditional African crops as the continent's most important staple food crops. The introduction to China of New World food crops, in particular potatoes, corn, and peanuts, resulted in a population boom between 1500 and 1650. By the 18th century, over one-third of the world's population lived in China. The Columbian Exchange was global, introducing new foods to every corner of the world. Before 1492, there were no oranges in Florida, no bananas in Ecuador, no paprika in Hungary. The exchange brought tomatoes to Italy, coffee to Colombia and Indonesia, pineapples to Hawaii, rubber trees to Africa, chili peppers to Thailand, China, and India, and chocolate to Switzerland. The landfall of the three small ships on an island in the Bahamas brought about unprecedented change in the course of history. It shaped the future of humankind for centuries to come, not just because of the discovery of a new continent, but because it brought about regular contact between the Earth's hemispheres, engendering trade, allowing for an exchange of ideas, and creating connections and encounters between cultures. In 1492, the peoples of the world began to come together as a global society, and that is good for all peoples.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.